is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Jack Beatty. Thus far, the threat of exposure to anthrax is far from being a mass danger, but it's real on Capitol Hill. More than 30 staffers from the office of Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle and three from the office of Senator Russell Feingold have tested positive for exposure to anthrax spores. And there's evidence of anthrax in the New York City office of Governor George Pataki. In Washington and New York today, there were calls at once for calm and concern from House Speaker Dennis Hastert, Senator Tom Daschle, the Surgeon General David Satcher, and New York Governor George Pataki. We begin with the Speaker of the House.
We don't have the test back, but we know that it was sophisticated in that it was very friable. It was almost an aerosol type of a situation on a powder. And when they opened the envelope, this thing sent out a flume. And we have, at recent count, probably 30 people or so that have been infected with it.
Mr. Speaker, there's our report.
And the good news is that everyone will be okay. I am very confident about that, given the medication and the fact that it was provided early, and it is continuing to be provided. So we feel very good that circumstances are well in hand.
You know, I understand the anxiety. I understand the fears that people have. But people should also understand that you can do a lot of harm to yourself and others by taking antibiotics when you don't need it.
We're going to continue to live our lives as New Yorkers. Maybe we'll be a little bit more diligent and a little more cautious in what we do, but we're not going to overreact. We're going to make sure that not only do we get through this particular incident, but that we as New Yorkers and as Americans continue to live our daily lives as we have a right to live.
That was House Speaker Dennis Hastert, Senator Tom Daschle, Surgeon General David Satcher, and New York Governor George Pataki. Now, the latest on this rapidly developing story, reporter Gail Chaddick of the Christian Science Monitor joins us from Washington, D.C. Gail, good to speak to you again.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Gail, this is the unbelievable following the improbable.
Yes.
Can you give us a sort of word picture of the climate of a feeling on Capitol Hill now? What's it like there?
It's a very odd feeling, actually. There is a great sense, especially on the Senate side, of wanting to keep things simple, calm, and clear. And that message is running all the way from the leadership on down. There's a real care to stop rumors before they get racing off too far, and to just provide consistently clear information. You often see people just talking to each other in corridors, running over what they've just heard, and always in a calm way. At the same time, I just left the Russell office building, where there was a line that ran around three corners of that building. And the young woman at the end of the line I spoke to knew that she had a 3.5-hour wait. She had had no exposure, from what I could tell. She hadn't been in the Hart building on Monday. The last time she'd been there was Friday. And yet, she was still waiting, or willing to wait in this extremely long line for however long it took, just to be sure.
She was waiting for a test.
That's right.
Yeah, yeah. Now, there's been a difference between how the House and the Senate have reacted on this. Can you tell us about that?
Yes. I'd have to say I don't personally think the difference is as great as it looks to the press. What happened was that Speaker Hastert, while the Senate was still meeting on this question, while senators were meeting in a group, Speaker Hastert came out and said that the prudent thing was simply to close the office buildings and suspend work at the end of the day. He used terms like, these are very, very severe times. Terrorists want to take away our liberty and our freedom. We need to be prudent. We need to do the work of the American people, but we need to do it in a safe environment, and this is the best track to follow.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he was followed with Senator Daschle, who had gone into a meeting with senators with pretty much the same idea in mind. He and Hastert had spoken early this morning, and they had both gone out of that meeting with the understanding that both the House and the Senate would end business at the end of the day and shutdowns to do a thorough environmental sweep. But when Daschle came into his meeting, he found a very different mood. Senators were in no mood to back off or to give the slightest indication that they were yielding to terrorism. They wanted to stay, they said so, and at the end of the meeting, Daschle agreed with them.
They wanted to send a message just by their being there, that they were deterred by this.
That's
and, of
right.
course, this was a bit embarrassing for Speaker Hastert, I should imagine, since he and Senator Daschle had worked out an agreement, and embarrassing for Daschle.
That's right.
Yeah, yeah.
Embarrassing for Daschle, I'm not quite so sure, because it didn't really come out, you know, in publicly as, you know, an agreement that was violated. They talked early in the day, and if there's one thing that's for sure about this story, it's changing all the time. People are aware of that. You just kind of regroup, you take account of the new information, and you move on.
Now, one of our producers here, in talking to you, said you had said something about a scan being done of the Capitol building, and I just couldn't believe what I was listening to. Can you talk about that?
Well, oddly enough, apparently this had nothing to do with the September 11th events. At least they're downplaying it. But they have scanned the building to a 16th of an inch so that if it ever had to be put together again, it could be.
That is sort of at the furthest reach of nightmare, isn't it? Huh?
It is. You know, I was just thinking about a number of things that have crossed my desk in the last couple of hours. I just was invited to a seminar called "What If Congress Were to Be Obliterated."
What if Congress were to be obliterated?
Yes. This is next Monday. And this is, you know, a political scientist talking about an interesting constitutional question. You know, if a senator, for some reason, dies in office, he can be appointed by a governor. But a House member cannot. House members can only be replaced by an election. And so if a plane were to have hit the Capitol instead of the Pentagon, and a number, considerable number of congressmen, died in the attack, how would they be replaced? And do we need to do something constitutional about that? Well, that's a very sober question.
Before September 11th, that would have been, in a movie, that would have been rejected as just simply...
I don't think you would have gotten a large turnout to a seminar called "What If Congress Were Obliterated," unless it were by fans who were eager to think that that would be a happy prospect.
We're talking about the anthrax scare on Capitol Hill and beyond there and its impact on a nation struggling to heal. Is there a psychological prophylaxis against this unprecedented fear? You can join the conversation at 800-423-TALK, 800-423-8255. I want now to bring in Dr. Ian Miller. Dr. Miller is a clinical psychologist in New York City who volunteered to serve at Ground Zero shortly after the September 11th attacks. Welcome, Dr. Miller.
Hi. It's good to be here.
Well, thank you. There's a parable, a dark parable of Franz Kafka's about a leopard and a temple. And the first time the leopard comes to the temple and takes away a human being, there's shock, there's outrage. People can't believe it. But the next week he comes back at the same time and they've said, well, maybe we can give him another. And sure enough, as he keeps coming back to the temple, people regularize this outrage and they sort of accept it as the new normal. Are we doing something like that psychologically with these shocks we're getting?
I think we'd like to believe we were. I think it's important to think about the last month in all its parts. That is, it began with the attack on the World Trade Center and it moved into the bombing and then into our television watching of bin Laden and then the anthrax business and the Cipro. Each one of these, I think, has destabilized people, and I think we'd like to believe that we're tolerating all of it and getting used to the new normal. On the positive side, I think most of us have done a terrific job in beginning to cope with what was previously unimaginable. It's important to remember that we're all very, very anxious.
And what's the content of that anxiety? It's real fear, not just neurotic anxiety this time, right?
Well, actually, Rudy Giuliani today, I thought, was brilliant. He addressed the number of positive tests, but the lack of any fatalities here in New York. And he said This is psychological. I think it's important to remember that terror is an attack not only upon physical well-being, but also, and very directly, upon the mind.
Mm.
Bin Laden told us that on TV. That was his message. And the fear it induces is psychological. Worry, panic, confusion, helplessness. So I've begun thinking about the idea of a psychological homeland defense.
Mm-hmm. What form would that take?
Well, we'd have to begin to grapple with external environmental realities that we've never had to think about before, horrific things, and come to approach them critically. And also understand that as we're doing that, we're doing it in an atmosphere of uncertainty, that nobody has a definitive approach. I think we just heard that in terms of the way the Senate and the House are handling this. It's important to relearn how to think.
How to think?
How to think. In situations of great stress, we react. We want to be able to do something.
Mm-hmm.
We are either paralyzed or we leap into the situation. Here in New York, immediately after the bombing, there was a wonderful outpouring of volunteerism. People are still doing it, and it underlined the good in us. It was tremendously heartening and in great distinction to the awfulness we were seeing. And across the country, a feeling of solidarity and purposiveness coming together, and a real desire to understand what's happening, to share and seek information.
And that was a kind of defense mechanism, wasn't it?
It's a productive defense mechanism,
mm-hmm.
And especially in the first stage of this. It shows that we are adapting,
mm-hmm.
and that's good.
Mm-hmm.
There are some difficulties, however.
Mm-hmm.
None of the individual actions themselves achieve closure under these kind of conditions of ongoing threat. And each one of the threats, of course, is different. So each has a kind of trail of things that people begin to consider as the threats pile up.
Mm-hmm.
The actions that individuals do, for example, volunteering with the Red Cross, bringing food to fire stations, that kind of thing, reduce anxiety temporarily, but they don't eliminate it. And over time, there's a growing sense of, for everybody, I think, of frustration because there's no closure. And what we do is we begin to think. We begin to think in the service of lessening our anxiety, or we think we're thinking. But this anxious kind of thought is unequal to the challenge.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And it's an anxious, it's a charged thought, right? I mean, it's not just some neutral ratiocination. We're our minds are charged over this issue.
Oh, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
That the senators are talking calmly in the corridors is enormously heartening.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's terrific because people have to seek other people to clarify what their own thoughts are.
Mm.
And opinions are going to vary. Some people can tolerate stress levels that other people can't. And, you know, mm-hmm. thinking about this the finance seminar for last week or for next week on what happens if Congress is obliterated, that's for some that's going to be unthinkable. And what will develop from it is a kind of a trail of internal terror. That's the kind of thing. Mm-hmm. If we're talking about establishing an internal beachhead in each of us, that we've got a short circuit.
Mm.
We can't let our thoughts run away too far. We have to, I believe, continue with our daily lives with the least degree of constriction if we're going to defeat terror.
Yes.
It's for each one of us to do.
Thank you. As the anthrax threat widens, what is the state of the national psyche? Join the conversation by calling 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. I'm Jack Beatty. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR Boston. This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Jack Beatty. We're talking this hour about the anthrax scare and its effects on our minds. Join the conversation at 800-423-TALK, 800-423-8255, or join the conversation on our website. Go to WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage Forums. Our guests are Gail Shattuck, a reporter for the Christian Science Monitor, and Ian Miller, a New York psychologist. Kevin is on the line. Hello.
Hi. I'm really amazed, actually, at some of the behavior by our media and our elected leaders in this crisis, which I think has really inflamed people's sense of anxiety. For instance, in the audio clip you played, Speaker Hastert said 30 people had been infected in the Senate, whereas in reality, 30 people had been exposed, and we only have 4 known actual infections of anthrax to date in the entire nation. Now, I'm wondering what, in particular, the psychologist has to say about the role of elected leaders and the media here in inflaming people's natural tendency to become excited and anxious, because to a certain extent we have very loose lips in the case of Speaker Hastert, and in the case of the media, we have people telling us what the news is and not really putting it in the proper context, which is that we have an incredibly difficult-to-spread disease which has affected virtually no one in the country at this point that's being treated as if there has been a mass epidemic.
Mm, thank you for that, Kevin. Let's first go to Gail on that. Gail, what about that? I've been struck with just the opposite, that the leaders seem to be toning this threat down to the point where their credibility sometimes seems in question when the next day's news seems to confirm the worst.
Well, I'm afraid Kevin is absolutely right about Speaker Hastert. I don't know why he's doing this, because I'm sure if you asked him directly, he'd correct himself. He's really the one who's doing it more than anyone else at this point. Even late this afternoon, he was using the term infected. But if you look closely at what most of them are saying, especially on the Senate side, there's a whole lexicon that's developed around this crisis. No one says infected or even test positive. The phrase is, there have been 31 positive nasal swabs to date. Now, no one is afraid of a positive nasal swab. Everyone is afraid of infected or tested positive. No one says contamination. They say we have had an incident of anthrax exposure. No one says that the staff is evacuating buildings. They say that the staff is excused. No one says we found anthrax virus on a letter, or even anthrax spores. They say there is a positive substance that has been, you know, it's this sort of thing. There really is an effort to change the language so it isn't sensational. Now, as for the media, I don't know that the media has done as well as the Senate is trying to do. You know, there's still, you sell papers, you want to keep people watching television. Even the, I've been struck by some of the kind of graphics around this and the music and the, you know, the way that the announcer will plunge into the story. I think your caller is absolutely right. This is being discussed in a much more dramatic way than it needs to be given the facts that we have.
Mm. Dr. Miller, what about that? The sort of new lexicon of fear, but of containing fear. Are our leaders helping us here, or orienting us to reality, or are they scaring us?
I think so far the leadership has been extraordinary. This is very, very difficult stuff to contain. I think Gail's pointed out the care with which people are approaching this, when they think carefully and can act in a unified way, is right on target. Certainly in the early days, right after the bombing, television video clips were very, very clean relative to things that might have been found at Ground Zero.
Mm-hmm.
But people are people. And people are anxious, both you know, at the leadership level and everywhere else.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of information and a lot of complex information that has to be assimilated and assimilated quickly under conditions of great anxiety.
Mm-hmm. But you're impressed at what the leaders from President Bush on down, have, how they've been reacting to this.
Our restraint, given our history, is admirable.
Yeah. Russ is on the line. Let's take a call from Russ. Hello.
Hi.
Hello.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I guess I'm thinking about your question about what we do psychologically and about your intro comment that healing is no longer a possibility or may not be a possibility. And I guess I have a different take on that. I think the psychological dilemma is a profound dilemma and an old dilemma that we've all of us have had for a very long time, which is how do we continue to celebrate life in the context of full-on awareness of our mortality? Mm-hmm. And that's not a new issue. Mm-hmm. What is new is our culture's adaptation to that dilemma has been punctured. And our culture's adaptation to that dilemma has been different than many other cultures. We have the luxury of being able to, relatively speaking, deny our mortality. We, I think, have a great capacity for insulating ourselves with material and busyness and business. Mm-hmm. And this has created a gaping hole in that denial mechanism. And so now we're confronted in a way that is very difficult. I think the healing comes from staying with fear versus as opposed to panic or terror, and staying with sadness as opposed to depression. Mm. And Dr. Miller talked about relearning how to think, and I think it's a critical matter to keep in mind that we can use our thoughts to gently move our emotional states. Mm-hmm. Because we can live healthy and we can celebrate while we're frightened and sad, but we can't while we're panicked and depressed.
Well taken, Russ. Thank you very much for that contribution. Dr. Miller, what about that? We're in a way, the sort of cultural blanket that keeps the thought of death away has been rudely torn away, and we're face-to-face with the thing itself.
I think Russ is right. I think there's another dimension I would add, which is that not so much culturally, but individually, we've also, all of us, had developmental traumas in our own lives and have attempted to master them, some worse than others. You know, they're the people who've experienced earlier traumatic experience like physical or psychological assault, violence, Holocaust victims, traumatized combat veterans, survivors of domestic violence. But for others of us, just growing up can be enormously traumatic, and we haven't fully resolved those kind of issues. They open up as more anxiety, more stress layers itself.
In other words, our personal vulnerabilities, given our maturation, given our backgrounds, these become sort of liable to insult and to upset from the environing conditions, from the outside world.
Sure.
Yeah, yeah. Jim is on the line. Jim, hello.
Hi. Great show.
Thank you.
I have a question that I think links back to the first part of your program. I was very interested when one of your guests just said that after an initial trauma, in this case it would be the bombing of the World Trade Center, people pour out to do whatever they can to address the immediate problem. And then as time goes on, as it certainly has in this case, they maybe tend a tendency to get frustrated because, in fact, the situation isn't over. And perhaps people lose the capacity to act in ways that are productive. Maybe they lose the capacity to think rationally. They just simply want something done. I'm thinking of that in the context of your previous two guests who were stating, in essence, that if the United States were to prove that the current rash of anthrax being circulated about in the mail actually came from Iraq, then in fact we should go after Iraq militarily. Mm-hmm. To me, that seems suicidal. To me, that doesn't seem like a rational thought. Mm-hmm. And I guess, in a nutshell, my question is what you were saying about the World Trade Center and people's reaction to it, the outpouring of goodwill and then the evolution into frustration, is that evidenced in governments? Is it evidenced in the collective? And if it is, what is it that we can do to keep it in check?
What do you say about that, Gail Shattuck, this talk about sort of out of our frustration and anger, the government doing irrational things, for example, perhaps widening the war on terrorism to Iraq, according to this caller?
Right. No, that's a real concern, and it is in peacetime as well as in, you know, a situation of near war that we're in right now. But there's something that's very interesting that's coming out of this that I don't know how it would fit into anyone's psychological model. I'll just tell you what I'm seeing and make of it what you will. But there is a lot more discussion of just facts than I've heard on Capitol Hill in a long time. I mean, you can go through whole days up here and never encounter a fact. You can see spin, you can see politics, you can see, you know, emotion or... But, you know, people just systematically sitting down and saying, here's the facts as I see them, what do you see? And then, you know, someone coming to terms with what a fact is. I saw it in an interesting way a couple weeks ago when the four people on the budget committee, on the Senate and the House, the chairman and ranking members, who have been fighting for months over the facts of what the budget is, how much is a surplus, how much have we spent, how much are we about to spend. This fall on Capitol Hill was supposed to be nothing but a fight over this issue. And they actually sat down and agreed on what the facts were and a set of principles to go forward on them in a bipartisan way. Around the Hill today, someone would be discussing a rumor. Someone would say, well, look, here are the facts as I understand them. Someone else would discuss them. I think the same spirit, if extended to foreign policy, could be a corrective to this. Mm. Because there are, you know... It can't just be emotion. Mm-hmm. I'm for Israel. I'm for the Palestinians. I mean, this has been a religious question in terms of how people discussed it mm-hmm. for a very long time. You know, you mention a fact and someone says you're anti-Semitic or something else. I think that this really is a time when people are looking at facts in a different way. Almost faith in facts. Mm-hmm, I don't think it's going to end when this crisis ends. Hope it doesn't.
What about that, Ian Miller, a faith in facts?
I think it's a greater faith in people.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things about people on Capitol Hill is that they're doing something, and they're doing something which has implications. They can collaborate with each other. They can problem solve with each other. That's a tremendous sense of freedom during these times. Down at Ground Zero, people pass each other on the street, and I've never heard more gratuitous thank yous. And I don't mean gratuitous in a negative kind of way. I mean, people are genuinely thankful that other people are in it with them. Mm-hmm. This is among people who have something to do. I think where the frustration grows is sitting, listening to discussion and the layering of tension that's external, however well presented, mm-hmm. and not knowing what to do with it, how to metabolize it, how to break it down mm-hmm. and parse it.
Mm-hmm. Let's take a call from Terry. Terry, hello.
Hi.
Welcome.
Thanks for the call.
Thank you. Hello?
Hi, I'm still here.
Okay, we're waiting for your question.
Okay, my question is, I think your speakers are making very valid points regarding the psychological damage that terrorism is causing our nation. And I have noticed that one thing Americans who really aren't close to New York and can't participate in helping the victims are doing is panic. And like you said, when we panic and we get away from the routine of our daily lives, the terrorists have won. And a great psychological defense to not let the terrorist win is focus on our anger at how outrageous these acts are, be it anthrax or flying airplanes into buildings, and not be mad and not let them disrupt our lives. I have colleagues that are even afraid if they get a chest cold, they might have been exposed to anthrax, which is ridiculous.
Mm-hmm. Use our anger to quiet our fears.
Absolutely.
What about that?
No one is doing that.
Yeah, what about that, Dr. Miller, using the anger?
Wow. Anger is a very tricky thing. Understanding anger, I think, even admitting that we have it and that anger makes us irrational, I think that's the first step. It's a powerful thing. I think we can sort of overextend ourselves through anger. So it's just a difficult thing to channel. I do believe that using our anger may lead to graver irrationalities.
Hmm. A dangerous substance, to be sure. Marilyn is on the line. Hello.
Excuse me.
Sure.
I'm calling because I've been thinking about the issue of how people cope with this. And it reminded me of the fact that I lived in Israel for several years during the War of Attrition. And when I came there, I came with an 11-year-old daughter. And obviously, we had never experienced terror or bombing. And the second or third day we were there, I was sitting with her and some Israeli teenagers who spoke English on a stoop in Jerusalem. And suddenly, for the first time in my life, I experienced a bombing. It was an apartment building not far from where we were. And I remember my bones turned to water and my daughter turned so white I could see the veins in her forehead.
Mm.
And we both sat there. She was always very tough. She was a very strong kid. And when she sort of recovered, she looked at this boy and she said, "Michael, what was that?" And he sort of shrugged his shoulders and he said, "A bomb." And she said, "A bomb? Well, what do you do?" And he said very calmly, "That's our country. You get used to it. And you learn how to be careful." And I saw the color come back into her face, and she said, "Oh." After that, she was going to the Hebrew University High School. She used to come home and tell me that somebody from intelligence came. They used to come once a month. What we should be careful for, what we should watch out for when we walked around in the street.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time we left, I have to say that I felt that I had lived in a society where, you know, I remember once a boomerang bomb coming into Jerusalem, and I really felt nervous. And I was stunned walking down the street and hearing people talking about the concert they were going to in a couple of days. And I said to a friend, "How can they do that?" And she said, "Well, we have to live, don't we?" And I think that this is, I don't feel scared. My daughter, who now lives in Ohio, does not feel scared.
Well, your story is heartening. Thank you, Marilyn.
You're welcome.
As the anthrax threat widens, what is the state of the national psyche? Join the conversation by calling 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Information on anthrax and postal guidelines on how to handle suspicious packages can be found on our website at WBUR.org, and then click on Special Coverage. I'm Jack Beatty. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. This is Special Coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Jack Beatty. This hour, we're looking at how to cope in the wake of bioterrorist attacks. How can the nation move forward when the future is so uncertain? Join the conversation at 800-423-TALK, 800-423-8255. Gail Shattuck covers Congress for the Christian Science Monitor. Dr. Ian Miller is a clinical psychologist from New York City. Nicholas is on the line. Hello.
Hi.
Welcome.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
First of all, my sister was a block and a half away from the World Trade Center, lived in Murray Street in New York City, and saw the whole tragedy. And, you know, her way of coping with this was just to talk to people. And I think the point, you know, even though we're in a kind of state of crisis right now, is that, you know, feeling a sense of sorrow, you know, sorrow is actually a form of healing. And I know one of the people on your program said we have to have, like, beachheads inside each individual.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that in this case that we can take crisis and really turn, you know, crisis is like danger, but it's also an opportunity to change our society. And I think this is like in a very strange way a wake-up call to really look at, you know, how we feel as individuals and how it reflects in our environment. So, you know, I think I know a lot of people who feel very angry and militant, but but others who feel, you know, scared and all that sort of stuff. But I really feel that this, we can turn this situation from a poisonous situation into like medicine.
And you think, and you think we need to do that by getting in touch with our sorrow, at least at the first instance.
Yes, in touch with our
sorrow. Not being afraid of it.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. What about that, Dr. Miller?
I think it's necessary to get in touch with what we're feeling. I mean, many people I know feel great and then find themselves involuntarily weeping. People I know who work down, work with survivors or families of the lost feel okay at the sight, and then 2 days later it grabs them. I think people experience a full range of emotion. And something that Marilyn said just a minute ago put me in mind of the Israeli experience. What she was talking about was a kind of strength, but also a pretty strong capacity for dissociation. Now, when you cut off your emotions, they have to go somewhere. Israel has the one of the highest incidences of traffic fatalities in the world.
Hmm.
Road rage is very big there. And I think that's something we're going to have to start looking at here in terms of anger management,
mm-hmm.
road rage, domestic violence. People are going to have to be aware of how much they're drinking or how much medication they're giving themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Are they arguing more at home in front of the kids or their wives? I mean, you know, we're going to see the effects of this dribbling out in many, many different ways.
And especially if we don't process, if we turn away from, if we dissociate ourselves from our feelings of sorrow and loss.
Right.
Yeah. What about that in that sense in Washington, Gail Shattuck? Do you notice people dealing with their sorrow, or are they putting it aside and putting a game face on to go on?
You know, I don't know that it is a game face. I hear people often talking about what has come into their life as a result of this. It reminds me a little bit of, your New England listeners may remember, Baldwin apple trees. They've almost disappeared, but they would produce fruit once every 2 years. My grandfather had them on his farm. And what he would do when one was getting, you know, older and not producing very well is go up to the tree with the back end of an axe and whack it. I saw him do it once. I couldn't believe it. I said, "What are you doing?" He says, "I'm getting its attention." And sure enough, the tree would produce much better the following year. I've sort of carried this mindless incident with me my whole life, and I found myself thinking about it today.
And what does it say to
because,
you?
Because, well, it says to me that out of real blows can come a kind of focus on what is important. And I hear that all over the place here. There were some first responders, you know, at the Pentagon, and some of the teams that were there from Ohio were on Capitol Hill this week, and they were just talking through, one of them, a diary of what he was going through. And what interested me was what was happening along the side. They set up a hotline 24 hours a day for people to be in touch with their families and for their families to be in touch with them. At St. Pentagon, same thing. There were chaplains all over the place. And as one fire captain said, we have our equipment to deal with this situation, but we also need strong beliefs.
Mm.
You know, he talked about the firemen are used to seeing horrible things, and they're used to, instead of saying there's a small wounded child, they'll say there's a broken leg, or, you know, a language mm-hmm. that will mm-hmm. make it less personal. Mm-hmm. He said that we have very sophisticated debriefings and defusings.
Mm-hmm.
He said, but all of that was penetrated by what we saw here.
Sure.
Now, everything that we learned before fell by the wayside, and we really were thrown back on our strong beliefs. And the phrase that mm-hmm. he used was the God of choice. Now, you can, you know, interpret that as you will, but he said we had people that were more in contact with rabbis, more in contact with priests, more in contact with their families, more in contact with whatever would give them a sense of why life is important.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it reminds me, you know, there's another meaning of the word to heal. It's one of the original meanings of the word is to be whole.
Mm-hmm.
And I hear people talking about things that they feel make them more whole,
mm-hmm.
more appreciation, for their families, mm-hmm. for their friends, mm-hmm. for, you know, the quality of their life. They watch different things on television.
Sure.
They listen to different things on the radio. Their conversations are different.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Making themselves whole.
Yes.
Let's take a call from Jake. Jake, hello.
Hi, how you doing?
Welcome.
I just wanted to just go back briefly to something that was said earlier about, and I'm sorry to break up the line of conversation, about the cases of anthrax or the exposures to anthrax. You know, there have been opinions voiced on this program and elsewhere that it's really not that serious. It's not such a big deal. You know, there's only four people that have been infected, and it's really not so much to be concerned about. But what I'm concerned about is that were someone to have walked into the Capitol building today or yesterday and had sprayed the area with gunfire, four people were seriously wounded, 31 people or 35 people, you know, 31 staffers from Senator Daschle's office were wounded, and a number of other people were wounded, there would be a national manhunt for whomever had perpetrated the crimes and whomever was behind it. But I think that because we're dealing with anthrax, which is a little bit more amorphous, I guess, than someone with a gun, mm-hmm. we're more apt to say, well, you know, they're isolated incidences, only a few, one person has died. Mm-hmm. And I think this, the bottom line, let's call a spade a spade. This was an attack on the government of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Plain and simple,
yeah.
And I think it really should be treated as such.
Is it that in the wake of September 11th, we're just taking this as yet another shock, whereas its unprecedented nature just doesn't leap out at us?
I think it might be. It very well might be that, coupled with the, like I said, the amorphous nature of, you know, of the weapon being used. Mm-hmm. But I think we need to look past the method and look at what's actually being done. And this
yeah.
was attempted murder of several dozen people.
Right, and people in our government. Thank you, Gail Shattuck. Is that how Congress people are looking at it, as an attempted murder on them and their staffs?
Oh, believe me, this is being taken very, very seriously. Bioterrorism isn't anything that public figures like to spend a lot of time talking about, but there was a briefing on the Hill yesterday with Dr. Kenneth Alibek, who was the first deputy chief of the civilian branch of the Soviet Union's offensive biological weapons program. He wrote a book a couple of years ago called Biohazard.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't recommend that anyone read it this week, but in a couple of weeks, pick it up. But he gave one of the most sobering presentations I've ever seen. In effect, you know, 30,000 people worked on this program. And the Dr. Alibek said that the big mistake that the Soviets made was publishing the stuff, so that now someone with for the cost of a translator can pick up, you know, the results of billions of dollars of expenditures on biological warfare. This is something that no one on Capitol Hill is joking about.
No.
Of course it's an attack on government. It's attack yeah. on, you know, much larger than that.
And it's
and billions have already been spent on it, and billions more will be spent on it. It's
mm-hmm.
a very serious issue.
Mm-hmm. Finally and briefly, Dr. Miller, do you think spending on these things, spending to address these challenges, do you think that's going to help us, the feeling the government is doing something, doing what it can?
I don't think capricious spending is an answer, but I don't hear that the spending is capricious. I
mm-hmm.
think today, earlier today, I heard John Ashcroft say that the 1,000 FBI guys were in the field beginning to investigate this anthrax business. People need salaries.
Mm-hmm.
Researchers need salaries. Workers need salaries. Life has to go on.
Life has to go on, indeed. Thank you. Thank you, Ian Miller, and also Gail Shattuck. Gail Shattuck covers Congress for the Christian Science Monitor. Ian Miller is a clinical psychologist in New York. To continue the conversation, go to WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage Forums. Now, a view from a college campus. Ewan McDougall is a junior at Yale University. He says there is no better use of his Yale education than defending his country.
About this time 1 year ago, I decided to join the United States Marine Corps. I spent 6 weeks this past summer in Quantico, Virginia, at Officer Candidate School, undergoing the first phase of training. I joined for two reasons, to serve my country and to seek self-improvement in ways I never could at Yale. I appreciate Yale for the opportunities it has given me. I'm a better writer and thinker than I was 2 years ago. My abilities to reason and analyze have improved vastly, and I have forged great relationships with my peers. Generally, Yale is supportive to its students. Specifically, it promotes individuality, creativity, and free expression. And as a group, Yalies are exceptionally mature, bright, and plain nice. The question on everyone's mind, my parents, my friends, my fellow candidates, when they learned of my decision was, why on earth are you doing this? You go to Yale. Why waste your education and give up your life, possibly in a very literal sense, by joining the military? In my experience, that question is misguided. While it has offered a great deal, the Yale lifestyle, in many real-world ways, easy, pampered, carefree, protected, passive, and isolated in an intellectual and philosophical bubble where my most time-consuming activity is sticking my nose in a book, can only offer so much. In fact, military life, characterized by teamwork, harshness, discipline, physicality, and practicality, and by taking and overcoming risks, complements an academic life very well. Indeed, it was my Yale education that led me to make my decision. I have read extensively about the importance of love of one's country, of service to it, and of a strong military to defend and expand its interests, of strong, self-reliant, broadly trained citizens, and of the wholeness, honor, and glory in being both a warrior and a scholar. I have read extensively of the principles that go into founding regimes, of those principles that went into founding our American government and society, and I believe in them. As I approach manhood and full citizenship, I have begun to consider my patriotic duty. How can I express my gratitude and give back to the country that has given me so much? I like America, I like the Yale experience, and I like being here, debating and discussing in an open forum like this. On September 11th, all of that was attacked, and yet it can only exist in the first place because, to stand up and defend our way of life, we have patriots. I have decided to be one, rather than hope for a free ride or expect someone else to protect me. I can think of no higher calling than joining the Marines. Since September 11th, a day I could never have envisioned a year ago, concerned family and friends have asked me, what does this mean for you? Aren't you afraid you'll be sent off to war? And again, I find the question misguided. I respond that I've never been prouder of my decision. Indeed, it is exactly for situations like this that I felt compelled to join. And yes, I am afraid, but it is a fear that, far from scaring me into passivity, pacifism, or cowardice, calls instead for activity, courage, and patriotism. My country needs me, and it needs each one of you too.
Ewan McDougall is a student at Yale University and is enrolled in platoon leader's class. He plans to join the Marines after he graduates. We'd like to hear from you. How has your life changed since September 11th? How is the air war over Afghanistan or the anthrax scare here in the U.S. affecting you? Send your submissions for future radio diaries by email to special@wbur.org. You can listen to and read radio diaries featured on special coverage on our website. Log on to wbur.org and click on special coverage. You can also get information on anthrax and postal guidelines on how to handle suspicious packages there. I'm Jack Beatty. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR in Boston.